So we took on blindness, and we decided to take on, and to me that was a light thing. I didn't know what it meant. I'm not an ophthalmologist. I don't know. It was just a nice kind of game to play. We took on Nepal, because Nepal is a very poor country, and Nepal has a very high incidence of blindness. It's hard to understand what the situation is. The population in Nepal, the population in the United States, is 16 times the population of Nepal. And there are in Nepal 15 ophthalmologists, and there are in the United States 16,000. Okay. And a survey showed us that most of the blindness because of ultraviolet light is due to cataract. Cataract is an opaqueness of the lens, and it can be taken care of, in most cases, by an operation that in a mobile eye hospital takes 10 minutes and costs $15. Okay? Now, if you want to close your eyes for 1 minute, now imagine that you're not going to see again. And you're going to have to get up and go home and think of all the obstacles you're going to have. Think of all the help you're going to have. And as you get retrained, keep your eyes closed, as you get retrained, you'll have a dog or you'll have Braille and you'll have all these help systems to help you and special financial aid, all kinds of things the society will provide for you to help you out at this point. But now imagine you're living in a third world country where there aren't any of those support systems and the labor force is so close to survival that once you are blind, you are out of the labor force and the expected life duration for you is 3.5 years. But if you live onward because your family takes care of you in this hilly region, you may live until you die and you will never have your sight back because there is no 10 minutes and there is no $15. Okay, that's the emotional part of the thing. Now you can open your eyes. So we figured, well, we'll go into Nepal. Nepal has 300,000 people just like that. And we'll just get ophthalmologists from India, Pakistan, all these places, build eye hospitals, eye camps, do all this, and just get it moving. Well, what I started to learn was this was a big game. This wasn't little. In fact, thus far, we're 6 years into it, there are more people going blind every year in Nepal than we're yet getting ahead of. We're still behind. We're losing ground. And I saw that my 60s mentality was the mentality of kind of hit and run. You come in with a nice idea for a project, if everybody buys it, fine. If not, well, you go do something else. I hadn't ever learned to stay with something, to persist, to make a long-range plan, to make a commitment. This was a whole new experiment for me. A few years ago, Larry said, you know, the problem is that our overhead for our office and fundraising is eating up so much of our funds. You know, you watch, if you're a giver to charities, you watch what percentage is used for overhead. And in the big charities, it's a large percentage for overhead. He said, I think we should have an endowment to cut that out. Everybody said, great. He said, I'll take it on. So this is about 3 years ago, I guess, 4 years ago. So we went to granting agencies and they said, no, we're not interested. So he decided he had an idea, he'd start a business. He started a business. Now I can tell you that business, which is the Netty Corporation, the stock of the Netty Corporation has now endowed the Saver Foundation with a $2 million endowment. This took 3 years. So that 100% of the overhead and fundraising is paid by the endowment, so every penny that's given goes directly into service. Every penny, 100%. When you give money, it goes directly into the field. The company he started was a software computer company. It's on the Vancouver Exchange, by the way. What it does is it sets up conferencing through computers so that you can carry on decision-making and businesses and stuff. The first beta test site for it was the Saver Foundation. So I do my work as chairman of the board in my bedroom on a computer. I mean, if you think old dogs can't learn new tricks, it's incredible. And I talked to Mike Jeffrey in Barrow, Alaska, and Ned Willard, WHO, in Switzerland, and Steve Jones down at CDC in Atlanta, and on, Wavy in California, and on, and it's all done. We make decisions, we have votes, we do all this discussion, we have humor, we tell dirty jokes, we do it all on this computer. It's extraordinary. It's the latest dance. What we found, like our board meetings, where there's 16 of us on the board, our board meetings are really fierce. They are like encounter groups. They are knock-down, drag-out groups, because what we're demanding is that the means and the ends be of the same stuff. Some of us came in, like Nicole, they were focused on the end. Let's get rid of blindness. And I come in saying, how we get rid of blindness is as important as that we get rid of blindness. And she says, I'm not interested in how we get rid of it, just get rid of it. And we meet like this. Because we're coming from different kinds of service backgrounds. And we struggle and work with this and fight it out and argue it. And the growth in all of us is incredible. And it's hard. It's not easy. And what we began to see was the dynamics of a group trying to do service together at a conscious level. Now, there are many crises that come up where a group gets together to do an action, and they'll do it for all different motives, and you say, let's just get it done. I mean, if there are homeless people on the street, let's get them so they don't freeze to death. Let's do something now. And you don't say, well, if you're feeling too angry, don't do it. You say, do it. Let's get it done. But when you're in a long-term project, you've got to understand that how you serve has a lot to do with what level of suffering you will relieve. Because you find out it's not just that you give somebody food, it's how you give them food. Whether you make them feel less by the way you gave them food or more. Do you see them as a fellow soul so that the giving and the receiving is nothing? Did you end up graced by their accepting the food? Or do you think you did something for somebody? These are all levels of consciousness of service. So what we're doing now is we're trying to just support the compassionate heart in the society. And we're probably going to set up, we're starting to set up local groups in every city of people who would like to get the same juice we get out of service. SEVA groups. And they may not have anything to do with SEVA. They may set up and decide to work for Oxfam or for the homeless or for something else. It's just a group that comes together. Maybe they're all serving already. Maybe they're taking care of their children or nursing. And they come together only in order to reinforce their appreciation that you can grow through service. You don't have to burn out through service. Paul Gorman and I did a book called How Can I Help? Which is really approaching these topics. That's what we're trying to do in this book. Deal with the way in which you can help that you grow towards freedom. That you look directly at suffering. Because if you think your happiness in this society comes from turning your eyes away from people that are suffering, believe me, your happiness is riddled with fear. It was a moment, I've told this story, of standing in Marin County at the beach naked with a frisbee. I told it last time I was in this hall. Now, you may not want to visualize that. That's all right if you don't want to. I was there with a frisbee, and the question was, as I stood there about ready to throw the frisbee, into my mind came the image of Gandhi's tomb. And over Gandhi's tomb is written, think of the poorest person you've ever seen and ask whether your next act will be of any use to that person. Do you throw the frisbee or don't you? That's our question for ourselves, really. See, we have, each of us has a unique dharma or a unique path or a unique way through. The game isn't that all of us become alike. Each of us is hearing a different message of what our unique path is. In our inner hearts, and it feels right on. And for you to deny the beauty in order to deal with the humiliated, or deny the humiliated in order to deal with the beauty, You're all of those things. You've got to listen to all those messages. You've got to enjoy the joy of the good fortune you have in life. To be affluent, to be in this society, to have these kinds of freedom that you have. And at the same moment, you've got to keep the heart, the compassionate heart open. It's that balancing that we're playing with. Yes, I threw the frisbee. And I continue to throw the frisbee. To me, life is joy. And the joy can include the service. Instead of the joy or the service, the joy through the service. It's all of it. It's all of it. The theme of this was really a quote from Saraha. I'm nearly done now. She says, "He who clings to the void and neglects compassion does not reach the highest stage. But he who practices only compassion does not gain release from the toils of existence. He or she, however, who is strong in practice of both, remains neither in samsara or nirvana, remains neither in form nor formless. There is nowhere to stand. Yes, we are compassionate, but don't be busy being compassionate. Yes, it is all a dream and we are empty, but don't be busy being empty. You and I will find as we go on this journey that we are less and less definable. I have no idea who I am or what I'm doing here or what I'm supposed to do. Oh, I can give you any number of scenarios, but they're all just relatively real. There are other levels and other levels and other levels of what you and I are doing in this hall tonight. And finally, you don't even care. I mean, I don't even care what I'll do when I grow up. Because it's just going to be more of this and more of this and more of this. And this moment is enough. This is what this is about. And if there's suffering, if there, whatever there is at this moment, that too. That too. That too. If you're tired of sitting at this moment, that too. It's okay. That too.